I love playing with compound interest calculators. And one equation I'm routinely calculating is the number of years until I reach financial independence. Using the 4% rule, I multiply my living expenses by 25 to get my FIRE number. I use that, my current net worth, and various contribution rates to predict when I'll reach FI. But then I start thinking about this equation. Instead of using my current expenses, should I be using an inflation-adjusted number that would more realistically match my future expenses? Also, now I'm second-guessing my average rate of returns. Does that include inflation, or should I be adjusting that rate too? All of a sudden, I'm a little turned around, not knowing if the number in front of me is an undershot or an overshot. I don't want to be so far off the mark that my calculation isn't giving me a realistic path to financial independence. So, what is the right way to account for inflation whenever running our numbers? Luckily, Jesse Kramer is back to tell us the right way to go about this calculation. Jesse has a way of simplifying topics. He routinely does this through his podcast, The Best Interest. Jesse takes complex financial topics and puts them into layman's terms. Jesse is so good at doing this that this is actually his third appearance on The Struggle Is Real. I love having him on the show, and I'm continuously inviting him back. In this episode, we get straight into the topic of inflation and answer questions like why products get more expensive over time, two ways to correctly calculate your FI number, and how to protect your portfolio from inflation. So if you're ready for that, let's get into it. I hope you enjoy my conversation with TSIR's most frequented guest, for now, Jesse Kramer. You know those moments where you think, I wish I would have learned this in school? Those are the topics that we love to talk about. Join me each week as I interview experts sharing their strategies for solving problems that us young adults will face throughout our 20s and 30s. So what are you waiting for? If you want new episodes about adulting advice every Monday, hit that follow button. Well, Jesse, welcome back on The Struggle Is Real, first three-peat guest, although I'm going to have to quickly invite you back on for a fourth because Sean Mullaney is coming on the show in 2 weeks, and he is also a two-peat. He'll be a three-peat here soon, so you guys are kind of duking it out as my most frequented guest, but I'm excited to cover today's topic, which is inflation. If people want to go check out some of your other episodes, episode 75, we talked about investing during a recession, and of course, that was in this midst of what we thought was going to be maybe a long recession. And of course, we went on a tear there afterwards. And you gave some very sage advice in that. And then last fall, you came on and talked about how to ask for a raise. So another really great conversation. So you can go check those out. But I want to ask you and really have a deep conversation about inflation. And this piqued my interest after I read one of your blog posts that we'll reference here in a little bit. But I think most of our listeners know what inflation is. Like, I buy bread for, I don't even know how much bread is right now, but a loaf of bread for $3 today. And in 10 years, that same loaf of bread will be $4.25. So I think we understand what inflation is doing, but I really want to know why, like, what causes inflation? So why do things cost more over time?
Justin, thank you for having me on. I'm happy to talk about bread, and we are going to talk about the bread example for sure. No, it's fun to be here again, and I'm in great company, I feel like, with Sean Mullaney as another three-peat guest. I aspire to be what Sean is someday, which is as knowledgeable about the tax code as one
can
get.
Insane.
But yeah, that's a great question. Okay, let's talk about bread. Now, when it comes to the price of bread changing over time, we can look at that and say, well, maybe a specific event occurred that affected bread and bread alone, higher demand for bread or a lower supply of ingredients for bread, something like that, and supply and demand affect price. Or maybe we say an economy-wide event occurred that in some way, shape, or form decreased the purchasing power of money overall, and that a dollar simply isn't as valuable today as it once was. And therefore, it just takes more of those dollars to buy the same exact loaf of bread. And so if we look at bread alone, it's difficult to determine which of those two explanations is true. And that's why, as we'll probably get into today, a really important detail about inflation is that inflation is this phenomenon that in some way, shape, or form affects the entire economic system, not just one product. Some products more than others, sure. you know, we're familiar with how gas prices fluctuate on a daily basis. Well, that's not inflation. That is usually just something short term based on supply and demand. But it leads to maybe a more important conversation that we're going to get into, which is how exactly do you measure this economy-wide inflation?
Yeah. Yeah. Let's continue to go on that. What is the measurement of inflation? When people tell me inflation's up 2.5%, how are they calculating that? Like, is there somebody that just decides that? Do they look at their monthly expenses and they're like, well, mine are up 2.5%, so the economy's up 2.5%, or is there probably something more mechanical that's happening here?
Yeah. No, there is something more mechanical that happens. And essentially, in short, the government collects a whole ton of data. And when we look at, say, we can look at a parallel and talk about our individual budgets. When I look at my budget, when you look at your budget, Justin, and when the listeners look at theirs, there's housing and transportation costs. Food is a big category. We spend money on medicine or professional services or recreation. So we spend money on a lot of different things. And what the government has decided is that they need to look at pricing data for all those different things to truly understand the effect of inflation. And specifically, the U.S. government, there's a Bureau of Labor Statistics, the BLS, and they measure something that they call the Consumer Price Index, CPI. Now, BLS is not an acronym that people need to remember, but CPI probably is. You don't need to remember that it's Consumer Price Index, but when you hear CPI, you should be thinking, oh, this is inflation. This is inflation. So the BLS, they measure what they call it a basket of goods on a monthly frequency. Now, that basket itself actually contains over 80,000 items. Wow. Coming from 8 major categories, which will sound pretty familiar. Housing is one, food and beverage, medical care, recreation, apparel, transportation, education and communication is all one. And then the 8th bucket is just this kind of catch-all called other goods and services. And so all those different 80,000 items fit into those 8 major categories, and they all roll up into what's called the Consumer Price Index. And then by comparing that Consumer Price Index month over month or year over year, we can measure how the total price of the basket of goods is changing, and we call that inflation.
Interesting. Isn't there like 2 different CPI measures or something? There's like some services or goods that they carve out because of the volatility of it. And then there's this other basket that's a little bit maybe more of a barometer for what's happening at large versus maybe what's happening on like a month-to-month basis.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Justin. So what you're referring to there is what they call core CPI, which despite the name, core CPI is everything that was already included in CPI that I just talked about, but they strip out energy costs and they strip out food costs because those tend to be the most volatile. So you're exactly right. If you were to chart the CPI, the full CPI over time, you would see some pretty drastic peaks and valleys. But if you strip out energy and you strip out food and you just look at all the other items, that core CPI data tends to be a little bit more stable over time.
That makes sense. So going back to what you initially said, so I kind of understand it. If I'm making bread and it costs me more money to buy flour, I'm probably gonna have to pass that cost along to my consumer, therefore increasing the price of bread. But you also kind of talked about these macroeconomic impacts where the actual purchasing power of a dollar changes too, which I find fascinating. Can you put your macroeconomics professor hat on here and extrapolate some of those thoughts using some recent examples, like, for example, COVID or the stimulus package or interest rate hikes that have happened here recently? How are those impacting purchasing power?
Just from my reading, and listen, I'm an engineer who works in wealth management. I'm not an economist, I fully admit that, but I like reading about this stuff a lot. And when I do read about it, a lot of people seem to agree that inflation, it's easy to identify in hindsight. It's difficult to predict beforehand. But almost everybody admits that all instances of inflation share the common trait that it's caused by an increase in the money supply in an economy, which put maybe in more layperson's term is right. They're printing more money. There's more dollars flowing around the economy. And this should make sense, especially if we examine it through the economy 101 lens of supply and demand and value. So supply and demand dictate that if the supply of a product goes up while the demand stays the same, then the value or the price of that product will decrease. Too much supply, the price goes down. And when money is added into an economy, the same principle of supply and demand should apply. So if the supply of money goes up, but the economy is still only producing the same amount of stuff as before, and therefore the demand for that stuff hasn't really changed, well, there's more money spread across the same amount of stuff, and thus the price of that stuff should increase. And that's what inflation is. Now, the exact mechanisms, you know, if we kind of dig down a layer deeper and look at the mechanisms, they can be a little bit confusing, and there is a bit of a debate about how it really works. There's something called the demand pull mechanism, which is different than the cost push mechanism. It's kind of like this pull versus push. Is it that because you printed the money, therefore prices went up, or because prices went up, therefore you printed money? And it's kind of like, where's the cause and where's the effect? But underlying it all is the idea that you have more money floating around the economy, chasing the same amount of goods, and therefore the prices react and go up.
Makes sense. And no offense to my college, but you probably would have made a better macroeconomics professor than the one that I had in college. That was just a class that I really struggled with, and there wasn't a whole lot of learning there. So I would have been, I think you, wealth manager, engineer, you can tip your hat and you probably would do a sufficient job.
I would say a lot of professors are afflicted by the curse of knowledge. And this is just a quick aside, but the curse of knowledge is this kind of well-known phenomena in public speaking or in psychology. I'm not exactly sure where it exists in the world of academia, but the idea is when you know something really, really well, you forget what it was like to have no idea what that thing is. And therefore, you just assume that everybody else knows things like you do, or at the very least that they have a base knowledge. So you have this professor who's been studying economics for 30 years. He has no frame of reference anymore for what it was like to be a freshman who took like one economics quick course in high school and that's it,
Yeah. Maybe,
right? And so that's the curse of knowledge. It always stinks when it's there. And it's important for anybody out there in life, whatever you're good at and an expert at, try not to let the curse of knowledge afflict you if you can help it.
Definitely. So let's get into the heart of this conversation, Jesse, which is how inflation is going to impact my financial independence journey. Many listeners know, you know, the 25x expenses. So essentially, I multiply my expenses by 25 times. This is the nest egg that I'm trying to build in order to comfortably live off of my investments and no longer work. But what has me thinking in this is, okay, if my expenses today are $50,000, I multiply that by 25 times. Is that actually sufficient enough if I want to retire in 10 or 15 years? Meaning my $50,000 today of expenses are going to cost me maybe $60,000, $70,000 in 10 or 15 years. So should I be multiplying the 25 by that 60 to 70? And this is where my head starts spinning a little bit. Like, what is the real way to calculate my FIRE goal? Because I don't want to undershoot it and not account for inflation. So I wanted to tear this apart, and you had this awesome blog called Accounting for Inflation in Retirement and FIRE Planning. And we'll link it in the show notes if people want to go read it. But there's this mistake that many people make whenever they're actually doing this calculation. And I wanted to pull you in here so that we're actually correctly making those calculations. And you talk about the true world versus the convenient world, but I'm going to toss things back over to you to kind of help break down this calculation and make sure we're actually doing it the right way.
Yeah, no, you set the table very well there, Justin, because it's not only you, right? I was there too at one point. When I peruse these forums, I'm on the Choose FI Facebook group, I'm on the Financial Independence subreddit, all these different things, and people are laying out their math, laying out their scenarios. It is very common to see someone potentially double counting inflation, counting it more than it needs to be counted, and therefore they have this overly pessimistic retirement math that says that they won't be able to retire until far further in the future than they hoped. And it's just not accurate. Or they somehow undercount or they don't count inflation at all. And therefore, they have this rosy colored optimistic view of their particular FIRE plan that says they're going to be able to retire in 10 years when really they can't because they haven't accounted for inflation properly. And what makes it more confusing, and we are going to get into this with that analogy, as I call it, of the true world versus the convenient world, The thing that makes it confusing is some smart people who were very well-intentioned, and I would do what they did too. They said, hey, there's probably some math that we can do to make this easier, where we can just kind of forget about inflation altogether for some of our assumptions here. And that turns out to be a very valid thing to do. But the problem is they introduced this idea of, you know, we'll just dive into a quick example, inflation-adjusted returns. We've all heard it before. Probably most of your listeners have heard it before, Justin, where they say, well, the S&P 500 returns 10% per year. Oh, but if you inflation adjust it, it's only 7% per year. That is totally true. But now the question is, well, which one of those numbers do I use in my FIRE planning, in my retirement planning? You outlined the scenario, Justin, where you're going to spend $50,000 a year right now, but you're wondering in 10 years when you retire, is it still going to be 50? And it's like, well, if you inflation adjust that number $50,000 up, then when you're looking at your investment returns, do you use the 10% that you know the S&P traditionally returns over long periods of time on an annual basis? Or do you use the 7% with the inflation adjustment? So that is the heart of the question, right?
Yes.
When do you apply inflation and when do you not apply inflation? So yes, let's dive in, shall we?
Let's do it.
Okay. All right. So I want to get back to this analogy or metaphor, the true world versus the convenient world. A quick explanation of what those are and why I'm talking about them. And it has to do with that math that the smart people created that I was talking about a couple minutes ago. So the true world involves all numbers as they actually exist in our society and economy today. The convenient world involves some shortcuts that some financial experts frequently use. We'll explain both of them. I'll explain both of them here in the next few minutes. And the good news for listeners is that you can do your retirement math in either world and you will get correct answers for your life. That's great. It shows the power of, you know, smart mathematical shortcuts. But the bad news is that you can't flip-flop between worlds. Mm. You've got to do all your math in the true world or you do all your math into the convenient world. And that example I was talking about earlier where it's like, well, do I inflation adjust my S&P 500 returns? Do I inflation adjust my salary going forward? Like, that's where we're getting into the murky waters of how you go about this. So let's first explain the true world, because it basically is the world that we're living in. And I think that's the right place to ground ourselves. You know what? We're going to make this interactive, Justin. So when we talk about the true world, our actual society and economy, let's first talk about inflation. Is there inflation in the true world, Justin? And roughly, what would you count it as?
I'm going to say yes, and let's call it 3%.
Perfect. That's what I would do. That's exactly right.
You're giving me hard questions, macroeconomics professor.
So we've established that inflation is real. It is a real phenomena that prices go up over time, and therefore the money that you need, Justin, in 2035 is going to be more than the money you need today. And yeah, using 3% a year, I think, is a very reasonable benchmark for that. Great. Well, now let's talk about stock returns. Now, we know that stock market returns vary in the true world on an annual basis and can do so by significant amounts. Year by year, big changes. But if we zoom out to large timescales, say 10 or 15, 20 plus years, we see a pattern emerging, a smoother data set. And we know that a diversified stock portfolio over long periods of time has returned
10%?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think that's a great proxy to use.
Two for two. Let's go.
And now, so it's reasonable to assume that $100 invested today, well, is it going to be $110 next year? I don't know if it's going to be 10% in a one-year time span. But if I zoom out to 15 years from now, I feel pretty good about assuming that on average per year, it'll be a 10% return. And now that's important because that's a real... Oh, I'm going to pause myself there because I'm not going to use the word real. We'll get into that later. That's a whole can of worms. That is the actual return, right? Your $100 is going to turn into roughly $110 next year with this little asterisk because it's long-term returns, not short-term returns. We're not saying, oh, but it's only $107 because of inflation. No. It's a 10% return. That's called the nominal return for what it's worth. And that's the way the real world is. So we can move on. We can talk about bond returns if we want. I mean, roughly speaking, or if you look at the way bonds have performed historically, if you look at the way interest rates are set right now, a reasonable return on bonds is 5% per year. Okay. So we can use that as a benchmark if we want to include bonds in our portfolio. We have to make a little bit of an assumption here. As we do in all retirement planning, this isn't special for the inflation conversation. The assumption is that the future will reasonably resemble the past. Everyone listening is allowed to disagree with that assumption and say, maybe they want to say inflation is going to be 4% ongoing and stocks will only return 8% ongoing. That's fine. But the critical point is that the numbers here in the true world, the real world, the true world, I should say, I need to keep my verbiage straight here. Inflation is above zero.
Yeah.
Stocks and bond returns are measured using, they're measured using the actual amount of dollars in your pocket. We're not inflation adjusting them. And we end up concluding that, well, your future income will be higher than your current one, because at the very least, it's going to be increasing with inflation. Mm. Your future raises will be greater than current, because again, they're increasing with inflation. Your future spending will be higher than it currently is because it's increasing with inflation. Same goes with your annual savings on a dollar for dollar basis will be higher than current, again, because of inflation. And your future nest egg, or between now and that future date, your nest egg will be growing by some mix of the true world returns for stocks and bonds, building your diversified portfolio. So that's the true world. I'll pause there because I might have rambled a little bit. I might have slurred a little bit. So any questions about the true world, Justin?
Jesse,
you think that the listeners?
I think you did a phenomenal job there. So we're in the true world. We're making these numerical assumptions based off of the past and what is actually going to happen. So we can expect our stocks to return 10%, and we can expect inflation, our salary, our expenses, all of these things to inflate about 3% every single year. Is that fair?
Exactly right.
Cool.
Exactly right. And now someone listening to this might be like, man, a lot of those things that Jesse and Justin just listed out were all increasing by the rate of inflation every year. Mm-hmm. You know, if you were to put these equations on a paper, just everything's multiplied by 3%, by 3%, by 3%, by 3%. That's a little bit tedious. And those with a little bit of mathematical confidence might realize, well, wait a second, can't I just divide everything by 3% and kind of remove inflation from the equation altogether? Mm-hmm. And the answer is yes, you can. That's exactly right. That's what some smart finance people decided to do to make the true world more convenient for us. And we're here discussing this confusing financial planning topic because of that desire for convenience. So look how well it worked. But it brings us to, I still think it's a good idea because it does make the math easier, but those good intentions of turning the true world, removing inflation from the math altogether to make a more convenient world for us, it leads to this confusing situation. So welcome to the convenient world where inflation essentially doesn't exist. So in the convenient world, we have no inflation, just right off the bat. Our inflation that was 3% is now 0%. And what does that mean? Well, it means that our future income, whatever we're earning from our job, we have to assume it's going to be the same as it is right now. Maybe you could make the argument that you'll have merit-based salary increases. That's fine. But you won't have any cost of living or COLA increases. Mm-hmm. Because there's no inflation and COLA is a function of inflation. Your future annual spending and your future annual saving will equal current amounts. Again, you know, you asked the question earlier, Justin, you're spending $50,000 today. How much will you spend in 2035? Well, in the convenient world, there's no inflation. So your future spending will be the same. And that's kind of helpful, yeah, right, for the math. Now, your investments, they'll grow by 10% for stocks, we'll say, and 5% for bonds. We can still use that math. But now we need to somehow remove inflation from those numbers, just like we have from everything else. And the way we do that is by turning those nominal returns into what's called real returns, inflation-adjusted returns. So if we're still assuming that the 3% inflation is gone, the 10% essentially becomes 7%. The 5% return on bonds becomes 2%. Mm. Those are the inflation-adjusted returns on those investments. And you might have heard me right there use the word real. This is where it gets pretty confusing because in the world of economics, we use the term real return to describe the inflation-adjusted return that someone gets. it measures the change in spending power of those dollars. So you can say, well, if $100 turned into $110, great. That was a 10% nominal return. But inflation was 3%. So really, it's like my 100 kind of turned into 107. Mm. My real return was only $7. It's a little bit of a confusing topic, and it doesn't help the fact that I'm using the words true world and convenient world. And meanwhile, we have this idea called real returns. So I'll try to be very careful going forward. I'll try to use the term inflation-adjusted returns instead of real returns. They are technically synonymous, but man, does the verbiage get a little bit confusing. So I'll pause there just for a second. What are your thoughts, Justin? Are you with me so far?
I'm with you, but I do want to recap just to make sure everybody is with us too.
Yeah.
So it sounds like whenever I enter the world of convenience, inflation goes away and I don't have to inflate my salary, my expenses, and my savings by 3%. But my stocks don't also get that inflation bump of 3% too. So I need to reduce the 10% that is what we call the true number in the true world. We just need to pull back 3% more from that. Therefore, we can use 7. But we don't have to do all this crazy math on all the other numbers, multiplying it by 3 and making it, aka, much more convenient to do the math in the convenience world.
Correct. Sweet. No, that's exactly right. Technically speaking, you're doing fewer mathematical operations in the convenient world. Absolutely. You just have to make sure that you get your numbers straight and that you're not counting inflation where you shouldn't or discounting inflation where you should. You know, that's where you have to be careful.
So let's bring that example into it then. So whenever you're in these forums, you're on Reddit, you're in Facebook groups, etc., you see the convenient and the true world get mixed up. And actually, a lot of times, people are double accounting for inflation. How does this happen and what impact will this mistake make?
Yeah, no, totally. So let's use your example from earlier, Justin. And you say to yourself, well, my goal is I want to retire in 10 years, right? And I'm spending $50,000 a year right now. Well, it's $50,000 a year right now. I need to adjust that for inflation. And we're just going to do this on the fly. And we're going to say in 10 years, I'm going to need roughly $70,000 a year in 10 years. And then I need to apply the 4% rule, which you do. So you multiply that 70,000 times 25. Technically, it's more like 67,000. But either way, the math on my computer screen tells me that in 10 years, Justin, for that goal, you're going to need about $1.7 million to retire. And what we've just done, just so everyone's clear, right? Inflation was very much involved in that math. So we are in the real world. Mm. But what's all too common is you'll see someone get that far in the calculation, and then they'll say, okay, now I'm going to think about my investment growth. And I'm going to think about how my portfolio is compounding. What rate is it compounding at per year? And they'll say something like, I want to be really conservative here. Inflation might be high, so I'm going to assume a 4% compound growth rate. Or a 6% compound growth rate, something like that. And you're like, whoa, 6%, like, how'd you get that number? They're like, well, my portfolio traditionally returns about 9, but there's 3% inflation. 9 minus 3 is 6. Well, hold on a second. If we're in the real world, you shouldn't be discounting your investments according to rates of inflation. You just take the investment returns as they are, because this is the real world. And the difference between that 9% growth rate and that 6% growth rate, when compounded for 10 years, that's a huge difference. Mm. And I'll just do some quick math here on Google Chrome to let the listeners know how big of a difference is. It's about a 60% difference.
Wow.
So it's you know, because it's compounded for 10 years. It's a 60% difference on what we said, like a $1.7 million goal.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not like small peanuts. This is not little difference at the margins. This is a big deal. And it's the kind of thing that in that particular case, it was overly pessimistic. And you might look at yourself and say, boy, there's no way I can retire in 10 years. When actually, if you just got the numbers right, you could. And this is a simple spreadsheet exercise that might take someone 15 minutes to figure out. But if they have the wrong inputs in that 15-minute exercise, it will send them down the wrong path for years and years to come. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of thing we're hoping to avoid here.
Yeah, I hope to avoid that too, because... we don't want it to be rose gold and people undercount inflation. But as you mentioned, many people in these groups I see double count inflation and people are then bummed out by the prospect of retiring in 35 years because they double and counted inflation, and then they just give up and don't even try it because it's just not worth it to them. So we just want to make sure you're doing the math right. Stay in the true world or the real world. You said the real world a couple of times there. So true, real, we're going to keep it the same. And then there's the convenient world. So you either need to consider the math in one versus the other, but don't conflate math in both of those worlds combined. And once again, you do a really good job in your blog kind of breaking this all down, putting numbers on an actual page. So once again, you can head over to bestinterest.blog and look for Accounting for Inflation in Retirement and Fire Planning, or just hit the link in the show notes and we can get redirected there.
Thank you, Justin. And I will say part of the reason why I wrote this in the first place was inspired by a conversation that I was listening to about it. And I was sitting there, two smart people. It was the Choose FI guys. If anyone out there listens to Choose FI, it was Brad Barrett and Cody Garrett. Mm-hmm. It's very coincidental that it rhymes. And I'm sitting there listening to Brad and Cody, and I'm like, I'm not sure I can follow what they're saying.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't blame anyone listening right now for being like, Jesse's so confused. He can't even get the titles of his worlds right. He's saying true now, and he's saying real world there. Like, it is confusing. But I do think that these visual aids that I threw on my blog at least help people understand whether they should be counting inflation, whether they shouldn't, and why.
Definitely. So let's bring this conversation to a little bit of a closure. And I want to talk about some strategic practices around protecting against inflation, because there is real risk when it comes to inflation, especially for 20-somethings that are considering early retirement, you know, early FI, at least in some kind of sense. You know, we really do need to think through how inflation could potentially impact our nest egg and our investments that we're going to be living off of for so long. So with that in mind, is there things that, you know, products or other practices that would help us protect our portfolios against inflation, both as we build towards FI and then actually the kind of the post-FI journey?
Yeah, I think there are. And let me answer that question. And let me also just a really quick aside that I was thinking about, Justin, because I know the question is going to come up. Someone might ask themselves, just back on that whole real convenient world stuff we were talking about, they're going to be like, well, what about the 4% rule?
Yeah.
Doesn't that already have inflation accounted within the 4% rule? And the answer is it does. But just for what it's worth, that whole real convenient conversation, Justin and I were talking about, and even in our examples were about getting us from where we are today to that point when we can pull the trigger and retire early. Once you retire early, boom, 4% rule takes over and you're golden, which, by the way, inflation is accounted for in the 4% rule. But to get yourself from where you are today till that point, that's where you need to be very careful about how you choose to or choose not to account for inflation. Now, building your portfolio, great question. What assets are inflation protected or tend to hedge against inflation? I wasn't sure if this was deliberate or not. I had a reader reach out to me in December, Justin, and the exact question he wrote in was, hey, at the beginning of the inflation rate hike cycle, everything I said read to invest in stocks and real estate and TIPS to beat inflation. Now, TIPS are treasury inflation protected. What does the S stand for? They're bonds. It's a treasury. It might be security. Yeah, it might actually be security. But it's a type of bond. It is securities, treasury inflation protected securities. And as the name implies, and I'll go into detail and describe a little bit more about TIPS, there is an inflation protection built into TIPS. It's a type of bond, which if inflation protection is built in, ostensibly, it'll be good at protecting your portfolio against inflation. But this reader said, hey, would you mind showing how accurate his kind of preconceived notions were? Do stocks and real estate and TIPS hold up well against inflation? Have they done so over the past 2 to 3 years? So that's a great question. And just because it's what this reader asked, I decided to look at exactly the time frame that he was talking about. I looked at my beginning date was January 2020, because not only was that before the rate hike cycle that we've seen kind of in the past, you know, 18 of the past 24 months, but also it was before COVID. It was before all of this drama about money getting injected into the economy and plummeting interest rates just to keep the economy alive as businesses were closing and all that stuff. So I looked at a few different asset classes from January 2020 to the end of 2023, just a couple months ago. I looked at stocks and real estate and tips because that's what the question asker Michael was asking me about. I also looked at cash because it's just the most basic inflation exposed asset class, and it acts as a really good baseline. I also wanted to look at traditional bonds and commodities. Commodities, oil, gold, timber, pork, now should in theory rise with inflation. You know, as the prices rise around us, the price of commodities should rise as well. So while the magnitude of commodity inflation might not match CPI data one-to-one every single month, over time, there should be some sort of correlation there. And just a real quick explanation before I get into the results, because I promised I would come back and talk about tips. Traditional bonds, a traditional bond, the way it works is you can think of it as a loan where you own someone else's debt. So let's use a US Treasury bond, very common type of bond. You literally are lending your money to the US government, and the US government is promising to repay you a certain percentage of that money every year, and then they'll give you the principal back at the end. So you lend the government $1,000 as a 5% bond for 10 years. They're gonna give you $50 a year for 10 years, and then at the end, they're gonna give you the full $1,000 back. Traditional bonds, while very stable, especially if the creditor is a stable creditor, which the US government is as stable a creditor as anyone in the entire world. So it's a very stable investment and a safe investment from that, you know, that risk of will I get my money back? The answer is yes for a US Treasury bond. But the risk, one of the biggest risks of bonds, has to do with inflation. Because the risk is, well, sure, you'll get your money back, but how valuable is your, you know, what was that bond example I just had was $50 a year for 10 years plus the original 1,000. So it's 1500 bucks at the end of 10 years. How valuable is your $1,500 going to be in 10 years versus the $1,000 you have in your hand today? And that's simply a function of inflation. If inflation is really high over those 10 years, you'll probably have lost purchasing power from that bond. Even though 1,000 turned into 1,500, it was probably a quote unquote bad investment because your purchasing power went down. So bonds traditionally are not a good inflation hedge. And the US government, the Treasury, realized this. So they created these things called TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Bonds, where it acts like a normal bond does, kind of as its base, but then it has this second portion to it that is a different payout, if you will. It's a different way that the investor gets money back, and it's purely based on whether inflation was higher or lower than what they expect inflation to be. That's important to realize, that TIPS, and you'll see this when we talk about the results of my little research project I did. TIPS, half of TIPS behave like a bond, and the other half of TIPS behave like some sort of inflation protection. And what did we see happen over the past couple years? Well, yes, inflation was high, but we also saw interest rates spike. And for those who don't know, when interest rates spike, existing bonds lose their value. Not completely, but lose value. And so what happened over the past couple of years was that the inflation protection side of TIPS worked as expected, but the bonds half of TIPS lost a lot of value. And so TIPS overall didn't perform maybe as well as people hoped. And now I'll make sure you get this link, Justin, so people can go visually look at this graph for themselves. Over the past, 4 years and change, my apologies. The total inflation number from January 2020 to the end of 2023 was 19%. If I compare that 19% against the six asset classes that we talked about, cash grew 6.3%. That's like cash sitting in a high yield savings account. Stocks grew 49%. Real estate grew about 4%. And that's a diversified, I use the Vanguard Real Estate Index Admiral Fund. So it includes a lot of different types of real estate, some commercial, some residential, some retail, et cetera. TIPS grew 11% over that period. Bonds, and this is just the US aggregate bond ETF, actually shrank 5% over those 4 years. and commodities grew about 42% over those 4 years. So again, inflation was 19. Stocks and commodities outperformed inflation pretty reasonably. The other asset classes, cash, real estate, tips, and bonds, all underperformed inflation by quite a bit. So I'll pause there.
I'm actually
that was a lot.
Yeah, I'm actually really surprised that real estate, you said real estate was 4% growth over that time?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
That surprises me too.
It's totally understandable. I mean, people are probably thinking like, what are you talking about? Houses are ridiculously expensive right now. My rent went up. How can real estate be doing poorly? So again, it's I do want to point out, I'm using Vanguard's most diversified real estate index, which includes many different commercial real estate sectors.
Oh, yeah.
Which got crushed by COVID.
Yeah, you're right.
Or similarly throttled by the interest rate hikes. So if you think of some large building in your city center that in 2019 was 91% occupied, and then COVID hit, everybody started working from home, and only half of those businesses came back to that building. That building is really struggling. Its rents are really low. It might not be making its own financing payments. And if that building needed to refinance any projects in the last couple of years, the previous loan that it was on might have been a 2% loan. Now it's paying an 8% loan. That's pretty hard on the overall value of that property as an investment too. So while residential real estate is catching fire all over the country, commercial real estate is in a vastly different place.
With the findings, is it safe to say then stocks and commodities may be the strongest hedge against inflation? Or do you want to put an asterisk on that and be like, it depends?
Yeah, I mean, it is funny because it's like, this. It's useful to see this data, but it's also, I certainly hesitate from drawing too many conclusions.
Fair.
Now, stocks in the long run have proven to be a great hedge against inflation. And there's a great reason why. And the main reason why is that over long periods of time, the number one most easily correlated data point between companies' performance and stock market returns is the company's earnings, how much money revenue the company's making. And when we're in periods of inflation, or even just when we're in kind of like normal, quote unquote, normal inflation, when a company's costs go up, whether it's labor, salary costs, or the cost of new machinery, or just the cost of goods sold, when those costs go up, they pass those costs on to the customers in the form of higher prices. Higher prices mean more revenues, more earnings. And so the stock price goes up. Companies are able to bake inflation in to their business and aren't that hurt by it when it comes to looking at the actual stock prices. So that's why stocks in the long run are a legitimate hedge against inflation. Now, in this particular data set I was looking at, it was a 3-4 year stock market return. I think it was a 4 year stock market return. So, you know, do I want to look at 4 years of stock data and make some sort of broad conclusion? Not quite. But when I zoom out to decades and decades, the same conclusion is there. Mm-hmm. So that's a good one. Now, commodities. I've got a couple different thoughts on commodities. When I see the particular plot in this article I'm referring to, commodity prices were very volatile. But on a bigger note, commodities are not income-producing assets, right? So if I invest in pork, which is a commodity, or I invest in gold, which is maybe a more common commodity that people are aware of, I buy that gold. That gold proverbially or literally sits on my desk doing nothing for years. It just sits there. And I have to hope someday in the future, someone will come along and pay me more for that than they pay for me right now. Well, if inflation does its thing, maybe they will pay more in the future than right now. But when I own a stock, I'm earning income in the meantime in the form of a dividend. Or I know the stock, that the company underlying the stock is increasing its earnings, thus increasing the value of the stock in the meantime. There is an intrinsic growth engine within stocks that does not exist within gold. Mm. And so that's why, just as a rule of thumb for me and the way I approach investing, commodities don't, I don't own any in my portfolio, and that's really the reason why.
That's fair. Jesse, as we wrap up this conversation, I don't know if this is going to be an easy question to answer or not, but should we, as 20-something investors, really thinking about early retirement, be concerned about inflation? Is inflation bad? Should we put a lot of thought into it? Like there are so many things that we're already concerned about, that we're already working through whenever it comes to personal finances and growing our wealth. Is inflation something that we should spend a lot of time thinking about?
It's a good question. I'm going to answer one of the easier parts of the question first, which, Justin, you said, is inflation bad? It's a very interesting question. And as consumers, we're probably quick to think, yeah, inflation is bad. And for what it's worth, inflation tends to affect lower income people more than high income people. Mm-hmm. So it feels like inflation in that way is probably unfair. Both very legitimate arguments because, right, it's, you know, if you have money, everybody's probably familiar with this idea. You have money sitting there in your bank account. Inflation occurs outside the walls of that bank. And through no fault of your own, the money in your bank buys less than it did before, right? And that feels bad. But for what it's worth, let's think about the opposite. Let's think about deflation, the idea that the cost of things around us are actually going down. And now our money does more. Our money buys more. Well, deflation is a death rattle. Deflation is like a red alert when it comes to an economy. Deflation means that companies are willing to sell their goods for less than they were before because they need to do whatever they can simply to have revenue. Mm-hmm. Deflation is a sign that people are probably losing their jobs. People aren't buying things anymore because money isn't really flowing around the economy. If you look at U.S. economic history and you say, well, when has there been deflation? There's really only one period, and it was pretty strong deflation, and that was during the Great Depression. That's not a coincidence. So we don't want to wish for deflation. The U.S. Federal Reserve has a really hard job that they try to do as best they can, although they don't always succeed, which is how do we make sure that there is inflation? Because we definitely don't want deflation, but we also don't want 9 or 10% inflation, which we did have for a period of time in the last couple of years. Because that gets to the point where someone says, hey, what the heck? My grocery bill just went up 15% in 12 months. Like my salary didn't go up 15%. So the Federal Reserve has this job of threading the needle, trying to keep inflation in that their stated target is 2%. Historically, it's been in that 2 to 3% range on average. And so from that point of view, I don't think inflation is either good or bad. Obviously, it affects some people more than others, and some people really don't like it. I think it's just part of life, part of our economy. And I certainly think it's better than some of the alternatives, which is deflation. I would rather have inflation than deflation. The second part of your question, Justin, was, you know, how concerned should we be with inflation in our FIRE plans, our FI plans, our retirement plans? And the answer is you need to make sure that it's somewhere in your math. I think it would be irresponsible to just wish it away. I don't think we should catastrophize and say, well, we saw what happened the last couple of years, and I need to assume that inflation is going to be 5% forever, because I just think that's worst case thinking. And I think the best way to approach these problems, you can bake a little conservatism into your math if you want to. I understand that. But we don't want to run into this scenario where we layer margins of safety upon margins of safety. And next thing we know, our true safe withdrawal rate is going to be, you know, 1.1%.
Yeah.
Because we say, well, what if the next dinosaur destroying asteroid strikes Earth? Like, there are some problems that are just too remote or too severe to be thinking about. So a bit rambly there. It's important that we account for inflation in some way, which hopefully today's conversation helps with. But I don't think early retirees need to be too fearful and lose too much sleep over it.
Yeah. And the one benefit of that early retirees have as well is they can always just go back to work. Like if you're in a period, let's say you hit 5 by 40 and you know you're 42, 43, and we do start hitting some periods of 9, 10% inflation for a couple of years, and you're drawing down on your nest egg faster than you anticipated, the nice thing is you're still very well equipped to go out and make money. So you could pick up a part-time job, you could ramp up a side hustle, or you could just live a little bit more frugally, which any heavy early retiree, early FI person is probably very capable of doing. So me, from a personal standpoint, I'm not trying to catastrophize inflation, knowing that I can take care of it in the moment if I am living through one of those periods in my early FI journey.
Totally. I mean, we talk about with 60-year-old traditional retirees, we emphasize at times, you know, the need for flexibility. The need for, hey, if you get a bad sequence of returns, there are some dials that we would recommend you turn down. Or, you know, ideally it's like, hey, hopefully you end up with more money than you expected and there's some dials you can turn up. And that's for someone who's 60, who has a, 25-year retirement or something like that. When we're talking to people who are in the part of the FI FIRE hopefuls, they might be retiring at 30 or 35 or 40, and they might have 4 or 5 or 6 decade retirements ahead of them. I think flexibility is mandatory.
Yeah.
You know, it's so important. And flexibility to work your way around inflation, I think absolutely falls under that umbrella.
Awesome, Jesse. Well, I appreciate you coming on, breaking down this complex topic. I know it's a hard one, but I knew you're up for the task because you do this a heck of a lot of the time through your blog, through your podcast, The Best Interest. It's climbed to be one of my favorite podcasts out there. It hit my top 5 on my Spotify Wrapped last year, which I was pleasantly surprised to share with you. It's so good. You do so many good monologues and interviews out there. So if people are interested, of course, go search The Best Interest on the podcast player that you're listening now. Or if you're more of a reader, which I'm probably assuming that you're not, if you're here listening to this, thebestinterest.blog, you can go and find Jesse there and sign up for his newsletter, which is also really great. Jesse, final question for you. You've answered this one a couple of times for me, so wondering if you got a new spin on it or if you're going to stick on the course here. But if you had the opportunity to teach a 16-week class to a group of graduating college seniors on a topic that isn't normally covered in the classroom, what would you teach and how would you teach it?
Yeah, I have answered this before. I was thinking to myself, Justin, before today, I was like, what did I answer last time? Because I knew this question was coming. And I think my previous answer had something to do with like statistics and probabilities. Because mm-hmm. I think that is a really interesting set of ideas that a lot of people, someone I spoke to recently, she was talking about her upcoming holiday travels, not upcoming rather, but it was this Thanksgiving. She's taking a trip to Europe. And we were talking about when she was flying back. And she's like, well, I'm not flying back that day because that's Friday the 13th. Do you think I'm going to travel on Friday the 13th? And I thought to myself, like, whoa, I understand from a superstitious point of view, but there's on average one or more Friday the 13th every single year. There's only 7 days a week, right? There's 12 months. There's 12 opportunities for there to be a 13th. We're going to get one Friday every year, maybe even two. And there are thousands of flights every single day all over the world. Hundreds of thousands of people are flying on Friday the 13th every year. I feel like I'm going Jerry Seinfeld here. And it's like, what do you mean? And so it's good. It's just like this idea of probability or just thinking about problems a little different way. But I want to give a slightly different answer today, a very different answer today, actually, I should say, which is some sort of course, because I could use this myself, on simple like communication tactics, not necessarily like teaching or like podcasting, but just interpersonal conflict resolution. You know, I feel like sometimes people in our generation, Justin, some of us younger folks, were a little quick to like stand down. You know, we don't want to get into arguments because we see sometimes, you know, maybe it's a bit of a stereotype, but we see sometimes the way the baby boomer generation, our parents, go about certain types of conflict resolution and communication styles. We're like, well, we don't want to do that. And when I look out in the world right now, I too often see people talking past each other. Some listening skills, some communication skills, some body language skills, how to have a hard conversation, how to have a hard conversation without getting into an argument would go a long way. I could benefit from it, and I'd be interested in taking that class or, if I knew enough, teaching it.
Well, I've asked you to teach enough today, so we'll set that one aside for a different day. But Jesse, always a pleasure to talk to you, man. You're invited on any point in time. So if you got an idea for a four-peat, I'm open to any suggestions. But once again, this is Jesse Kramer, host and blogger at The Best Interest. Jesse, it's been a blast. Thanks so much, man.
Justin, thank you so much. And Sean Mullaney, I'm coming for you next, man.
Thanks for listening to the episode. As always, I appreciate your kind words. If you want to leave us a rating and review on your podcast player right now, that would absolutely make my day. If you want to find episode show notes, our blog, and other great resources, head over to tsirpodcast.com. If you have follow-up questions, an idea for a future episode, or just want to say hi, we have a contact form on our website, and those messages go straight into my inbox, and I promise you, I will reply. But all right, guys, I really appreciate you tuning in. I love you all, and you're not alone. Let's keep making it through our struggles together.